I'll keep it short. Let's see. So the question is basically about, you know, how impactful are early relational experiences, right? Early social experiences, family experiences, peers, and so forth. And second, how to what extent can people recover from them, all right? And I said some things already about there's a natural neurological diversity of vulnerability and also diversity of events. All that said, the kind of current dogma I see a fair amount in psychology is to overemphasize the impact on the child's brain of social experiences in the first 3 years. Now, let's be careful here. I work with children. I did my dissertation on 15-month-olds, on parents giving them alternatives rather than just saying no. I'm the world's expert on that very, 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 very narrow subject matter, but it saved a lot of parents' lives. How many of you have been parents or are parents, whatever? You know, not the steak knives, Susie. How about the spoons? I did my dissertation on that. So, I love kids. I'm very passionate about that. And I think in the history of science and broadly defined, you know, public policy and medicine, there's been a grievous underestimate of the impact on vulnerable young children of life experiences, or just pain, like doing operations on infants without anesthesia, stuff like that. So it's in that context that I'm offering this potentially heretical view. It's just that as the pendulum swings in life, it kind of swings from one extreme to another, you know, too hot, too cold, too tall, too short, you know, too hard, too soft, you know, as Goldilocks said. And I do think that early life experiences that are social are obviously very important. But the brain is sculpted in infancy and toddlerhood and preschoolhood by so much more than relationships with mom or dad or big brother. It's sculpted very much by the child's engagement with the object world. Can I get the mouth on the nipple? Can I get the cup to the lips? Can I get the mashed potatoes in my mouth instead of my ear when I'm learning how to use a spoon? You know, can I walk? Can I walk better than other people? I mean, there's so much engagement with the physical world that is also shaping neural development in terms of successes and failures there. There's also a lot of engagement in terms of self-regulation and the capacity to be with the developing mind of the infant, him or herself, or toddler or preschooler. So much is going on. If you've ever worked with little kids, so much is going on inside their heads. It's not verbal. Infant means without speech. That's the root of the word infancy, without language. Yet, boy, so much is going on that's not linguistically based. So for me, that's very, very hopeful. And it tells a more complex story. You know, of course, catastrophic trauma is when a kid is messed with across all those channels. You know, horrible relationships, absolute blunt autonomy, no language development, never talk to them, you know, impoverished environment. Oh yeah, chronic pain. Wow, okay, that's a catastrophic situation. But for most people, yeah, there have been some serious problems with in the relational world, but there are still a lot of other capacities that one can work with, which for me is very, very hopeful. So that's my little heretical riff there. To close out that point, I think the truth is that we do not know the upper bound on personal growth and psychological rehabilitation. We don't know the upper limit. We don't know it. And so for people to say, you can only get this much gain, or people are irrevocably and forever traumatized, or you'll never recover function, you'll never learn how to love again, I'm very skeptical of that. I don't think we know the upper bound, right? I think what is clear, it would be a little bit like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci drawing pictures of people flying, and other people saying, humans will never fly, forget it. We don't know the upper bound. Why foreclose the possibilities? I just think that's unscientific, and it's pragmatically foolish, because if you think the possibilities are closed off, then you don't do those things you can to make it better. Second thing is, I think there's so many examples of people who've had horrible childhoods, yet through grace and grit, we're able to work with that, and as the attachment theorists know, work through insecure attachment, come up with a coherent adult attachment narrative and raise securely attached children of their own. I'll finish on this point. I'll just say it. I think the opportunities for neuroplasticity are just emerging. We're really just at the beginning of the possibilities there. Probably with some combination. You know, imagine, it's great to imagine, what's the therapist of the 21st century, 22nd century going to be doing? I think it's going to be a combination of sensible physiological interventions, most of them holistic and not medications. The appendix in my book, Buddha's Brain, is about nutritional neurochemistry. It's intensely referenced. Nothing in there is not referenced, basically, about things people can do without going to the physician to actually promote the physiological material substrate of healthy states of mind, particularly in terms of anxiety, depression, and attentiveness and memory. Okay. So I think the future therapists will be working that. Future therapists will probably be doing some kind of neurofeedback. And the future therapists will really be teaching clients skills in very, very targeted ways and interacting with them in very targeted ways that are deeply informed by understanding more about the black box. And I think when we look ahead to that, the possibilities there are going to be fantastic. Just to wrap on this one, and then I'll go back to the slides. Most of us are therapists. I don't know about you, but being a therapist a long time has made me more compassionate. It's also made me tough as nails. You know, in a sense that you got to earn it. You got to work for it. We were joking at lunch, how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Profound, but silly, but profound call on there. And I think, and my observation is, that if people really get on their own side and use each day as an opportunity to gradually change their brain for the better and stick with it in a way that would be obvious if they wanted to recover from a heart attack or change their blood sugar metabolism if they have type 2 diabetes or if they just wanted to get really good at tennis or golf, you know? But if people bring that same application to bear to their own personal development, the sky's the limit. The sky's the limit. And most of us don't do that work. My personal theory is that, you know, life boils down to little moments, you know, moments of awakening many times a day, where in any moment, the range of possibility for us in that moment is in this range. And that range moves up or down in terms of what we could do with this moment that's right here, right? Is it clear what I'm kind of saying? We could, like, let's say they say something. My wife says something snippy. All right, I've got a range here of responses and how I can feel and how I can act. Do I take the low road or the high road? Let's say something different. Inside my mind there's some kind of harsh self-critical thought, like, this is dumb, Rick, what you're saying. I have a range of responses, low road or high road, at that moment, for the next few seconds. That's all that's given to us. It's the next few seconds, right? Everything before, we cannot do a single thing about. Much beyond the next few seconds is out of our reach. But what's in our reach is the next few seconds in this range, over and over and over again. What we do in that range, moment to moment, is usually a fairly small increment. It's a small matter, right, for a few seconds. But if we string a lifespan together of few seconds, few seconds, few seconds, all the way across the lifespan, those little increments, whether we're at the top or the low end of the range of what's possible, build differences over the course of a lifespan, and from your perspective, time going this way, create a trajectory in which it's like that, fairly shallow, or like that, or like that. Or in the case of recent occupants of the American White House, like that. People who knew less when they ended 8 years after they began. So it's all about what we do inside that little range. Right? And I just think that's fantastic, because that's where we have power. Right? That's where we can be on our own side. That's where we can talk with our clients about the possibilities that are there. That's where we can talk about how what we do in those little moments actually changes brain structure. And those little moments, brick by brick by brick by brick by brick, determine the course of a human life. So let's do it, right? All right. Okay, on with some slides. All right, great. So, just positive resources. I just kind of want to review a couple of things, then let's slide into how to deal with trauma. So, taking in the good, whether a person does it in the formal way that I laid out, or actually in life, particularly if you play with this, you'll discover yourself just doing it more automatically. We had a little moment at lunch, for example, where we're sitting around the table, about 8 of us, and it just, you know, felt nice. And at one point I said, oh, this is feeling nice. And that was a moment of just registering the positive experience. I also think, sidebar, that as people practice taking in the good, in other words, as they practice the internalization of positive experiences into implicit memory, they get better at doing that. Those memory systems get fast-tracked increasingly, and the brain over time increasingly then becomes Velcro for positive experiences and Teflon for negative ones. And that's what we want to do. We want to shift ourselves over time so that the internalization of positive resources becomes the default state, becomes the rule, not the exception. I should say something here that I think is a bit of a conceptual structure. It's at least helped me doing therapy with people and also my own personal growth journeys. I think that personal growth boils down to three phases. The first phase is we step into an experience, or we open up to it. We allow it to be there. And I think that's so much of what MBSR, for example, is about, is actually allowing it to be there. We have to feel our pain. We have to experience the experience. If we don't experience the experience, it gets shoved down into the basement and it starts festering. That's phase one. But after we do phase one for a while, and then there's this sweet spot of how long is the right amount of time. Is it a few seconds or a few years? But at some point, when we're grappling with, let's say, something painful, something difficult, something negative as an experience, we move to phase two, which is releasing it, right? In other words, phase one, we engage it. Phase two, we release it. And then phase three, which is very often the forgotten phase, we replace it. Right? Engage, release, replace. And people can see where they are in terms of those three, their strengths and their weaknesses. I was really good at letting go. I was really good at releasing, and I needed to work on being with for a while. And then also I got interested in replacing with taking in the good. Taking in the good is about replacing. But it also improves capacities to be with and to release. Right? Does that make sense? See what I'm saying? It's kind of cool, actually, to think about it. People tend to err in terms of the first stage engagement on either being avoidant and, I don't want to feel that, or they get sucked in. It's like a black hole. They get stuck to it, flypaper, and then, you know, they need to go the other way. Right? Okay, great. So, yeah, Tim. So the question was, is there something about the MBSR protocol, particularly let's talk about the formal protocol, that promotes the release phase? So, in other words, and I think the answer is yes. I think, for example, there are people who feel like life sucks. I feel like crap. Life sucks. I feel like crap. They're engaging it, right? They're in it. But what are they not doing? For one, they're not disidentifying from it, which is absolutely central to the MBSR protocol. I think one of the interesting things, if you look at the history of research on psychotherapy, is the number of times that non-specific implicit factors have been revealed to be the really, really important ones. Right? In the so-called placebo effect, there's no placebo there. You're getting someone's attention, hopefulness is being kindled, you're in a relational frame. Those are mechanisms of action. So I think that quality of disidentification is really helpful to letting go. Another one is the establishment of this base. Remember I said secure base of operations, of this base in which there is suffering, awareness of self never suffers, right? To use the TV metaphor, there are horrific images on the screen, images of and sounds of agony. The TV pixels themselves are never sullied or tainted or harmed by what moves through them. And I think that establishing of a secure base in the MBSR protocol does help people then shift to a place of letting go. And of course, it's easier to let go if you've already disidentified from something. It's interesting to identify these. If you are interested in some particular kind of therapy, it's interesting, I think, it's very useful, it's productive to identify, you know, particularly the implicit mechanisms of action, and then really make sure those are being highlighted and cultivated. And then when people succeed at them, register that positive learning. Soak it in, you know, for example. How about one more person, then I'll move on. Yeah. Yes, thank you very much. To play a little, and people use these words a little differently, and it's all okay as long as we know what the local dialect is, right? But what you said there was great. Like, and I've thought of it too, these three phases as let be, let go, let in. You know, which I think is very close to what you're saying there. Yeah. So let's talk about positive resources. That's what we're cultivating. Remember, the question is, how do we build positive structure? We build, through taking the good, we cultivate positive bodily states, so that's something we can take in. For example, a sense of strength. As I said, I've done a fair amount of rock climbing. I also think about a time when I was in a situation with an apartment with a group of people, and some people had the apartment before, came in and told us they just wanted us to move, and they were going to move back into the apartment. We had a lease with the landlord, they were irrelevant, they wanted us to move, what? And I had a really strong sense of strength. Or I remember a time when this kind of creepy seventh grade teacher messed with my daughter, and don't mess with my daughter or my son, you know, or my cat. But anyway, and that sense of strength. That's a felt sense. That's something, that's a positive state that can be taken in. That's a resource. It's an available resource. That makes sense what I'm saying? We often don't think of bodily states as really important resources. They're incredibly important. The bodily state of confidence, the bodily state of healthy forbearance, patience, of healthy turning the cheek, turning the other cheek, what have you, you know? That's a bodily state too. With love, compassion, self-compassion has a very embodied quality to it. The embodied portions are wonderful targets to bring attention to in a mindful way and then soak in. And the others are fairly obvious. Emotional residues, that's definitely big time what we're taking in. Positive emotions. I look out at the world, I don't see any shortage of negative emotions out there. Look at the faces, people walking down the street, it's not like everybody's way too happy. I think it's okay to kind of balance the negativity, bias, result, etc. by focusing more on positive emotion for a while. And then also behavioral inclinations and repertoire. For example, when a difficult situation happens, do we tend to lean back from it? Or do we tend to, as you were saying, in a sense, lean into it? Do we move into it? That's a bodily orientation or inclination. When someone is angry at us, is the bodily inclination to get away and tune out or hunker down or fight back? Or is the bodily inclination to relax? Shields up, Scotty, very important phase, dealing with difficult moments. I think if we are to, you know, the classic line, fences make for good neighbors. To be present with difficulty, very often we first need to shore up our own defenses. That's something I think we often don't, that's a step we often don't take or don't take enough time with, particularly in situations maybe where we're working with people or working with couples. We don't promote individuation, strength, and safety enough before we ask people to really join and forgive and release and so forth. But that's an inclination as well. When someone's angry with us, you know, do we kind of gird our loins and then open and listen and try to figure out to the maximum reasonable extent possible, you know, what correction I could put in here? Okay? Okay. So, and then what does this cultivation do? It creates resources that buffer against stress down the road. Really, really, really important. That reduces negative experiences, which is good in its own right, generally speaking, and which also reduces, you know, wear and tear on the nervous system through the stress response system. It improves, and I'm missing an R there, it's not imposes, it improves the default resting state of the person. In other words, over time, people who practice the cultivation of internal qualities, including through methods like the ones we're exploring here today of taking in the good, gradually the needle shifts over time. To that gentleman's question about the impact of early childhood experiences, people really can change their hedonic thermostat setting. So I want to talk about that briefly. There was a fair amount of research on people who, the idea that everybody has their own kind of hedonic resting state. The idea that if something horrible happens, after a while you kind of recover back to your baseline. If something great happens, after a while you recover back to your baseline. That research has been really pretty overstated, and a lot of new research has shown that, first of all, people recover from negative experiences more slowly than they return back to baseline after winning the lottery or, you know, getting married. Second, that people really vary in their resting state. And third, people can actually change their resting state over time with grace and grit, you know, with making an effort at aiming at the high end of the range of the possible, increment by increment, increment by increment over the course of a lifespan. People really can change the set point, the happiness set point. I've totally personally experienced that myself, and I know that's also what the research shows. So we change the default resting state. And then last, in wonderful circular ways, when we take in positive resources, that leads us to do things that create positive outcomes, right? We act with more confidence, we act with more strength, it can promote a sense of virtue. For example, if we do a hard thing, and there's an opportunity there to feel good about ourselves for having done the hard thing, whatever that was, that then inclines us increasingly toward virtue down the road. All those are ways of inclining the mind in an increasingly wholesome direction, which can create wonderful positive cycles, including inclining us toward pro-social behavior. Here's the Bertrand Russell quote that I showed just before we went off for the lunch break. It's interesting that people who, as a generalization with many important exceptions, people as their mood increases, particularly from feeling really upset, as they move toward neutral and even toward mildly positive, pro-social behaviors increase. They're more generous, they're more forbearing, they have better emotional control in terms of not lashing out at other people. In other words, in a broad sense of the word, they're gooder, right? They're more inclined toward the good. Okay. It's interesting, the classic saying in Buddhism, is to use that as an example, is that the mind takes the shape of whatever it rests upon. So, do we rest the mind upon a sense of threat, self-recrimination, angry, repetitive quarrels in the mind with other people, our case about others? That's a term that's actually been very useful for me in doing therapy. You know, people often have a case about important others in their life, including the other they're sitting across from in our office if we're doing couples counseling. Do we rest the mind upon those sorts of things? Our own limitations, our own failures, the job we didn't get, the girl, the guy we didn't mate, what have you. On the other side of it, do we rest the mind upon the wholesome? Do we rest upon, you know, the mind upon our own good qualities, good conditions in the world, good events in the world? Do we and good feelings? Do we gradually do that? And then the mind takes that shape. That's the fundamental question. It's interesting that these days, so I was talking with Don earlier about Barbara Fredrickson and positive emotion. Positive emotion has been a great area of research lately, it's almost as if psychology has discovered the, you know, why it's good to feel good. Duh. But anyway, and you know, the research on positive emotions is a lot of proxy for the benefits of taking in the good, because to take in the good, first we look for the good, which makes us feel good, and then we particularly focus on and absorb feeling good, and then we cultivate, you know, the emotional residue resting state, the inner landscape or atmosphere of the mind becomes increasingly imbued with positive emotion, which then also inclines us to do those things that create positive emotion in the future. There's been a lot of research on positive emotion in terms of physical and mental health benefits. They're listed here. One of the interesting things about it for me is that they help heal traumatic experiences. Again, even in early childhood experiences, if a person today can start having a lot of positive experiences, and then, as I will get to in a moment, do the fourth step of taking in the good, which is to bring them into contact with that early painful material, gradually over time, that early painful material can be soothed and healed. People will not forget the events that have occurred, but the negative emotional associations and outlooks and behavioral dispositions and bodily states, those four targets again, related to those early childhood experiences, will increasingly be nudged in a positive direction. So I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. It's interesting to think about taking in the good neurologically, and so that's what this slide is about. And why don't I run through this slide, take any more questions about what I've covered so far, and then let's get into trauma and equanimity, all right, for the remainder of the day. If you think about it, number one, taking in the good stimulates and therefore strengthens, because as soon as you stimulate neural activity, you start naturally, it starts naturally stitching together and thereby strengthening, for better or worse. So if you're doing something useful or productive, like taking in the good, you are then, a person is then strengthening general top-down prefrontal executive capabilities, which then become enhanced resources for coping. Because when we do taking in the good, we're doing it deliberately. We are also very often creating context for this good experience we're having. Both of those, just generally, generically, support prefrontal cortex, PFC, and A, or H rather, for hippocampus capabilities. Second, when we have a good moment, in other words, when we have a positive emotion, but particularly when we focus on the implicit memory formation of positive experiences and positive emotion, we're gradually starting to desensitize this amygdaloid, sympathetic nervous system, hypothalamic, pituitary adrenal axis, stress response, networks. Okay, so far? So those are generic benefits. And then specifically, a person can internalize regulatory experiences. In other words, regulatory experiences themselves are, particularly when one works with populations who are dysregulated, whether it's kids at the spirited end of the temperament spectrum, or people with PTSD who are continually sucked back into it, or frankly, people who have compulsive behaviors, or you know, obsessively anxious, let's say. Those people need more regulation, right? If they're having self-regulation through taking in the good, that itself is a positive experience, which then stimulates and therefore strengthens regulatory capabilities. And then last, which is something I'm going to really go into in a little bit here, we can deliberately take in specific experiences that buffer stress or remedy past deficits, just in the first three steps. For example, as I said earlier, the affiliating system in the brain is critically involved, and it's one of the key things that should be in place in early childhood, and it becomes very problematic, of course, when the external provision of nurturing attunement, which is affiliating, of course, is in short supply. Right? That affiliating system is a critical resource for buffering the stress response. Remember how we talked earlier about how, you know, we need to be able to kick into that fight or flight gear some of the time, but to be in a chronic state of activation, including self-generating activation by anxious or angry or, sort of defeatist or helpless thoughts, it's really important to think about how to regulate that system, and therefore internalizing affiliating experiences. In other words, focusing on experiences where we feel connected with others, or that they care about us, or that we matter, often in fairly kind of minor or mild ways, like the people at the sandwich counter like us, or it was a nice moment with somebody at work, or the cat is sitting in our lap purring and really loves being there. Whatever that is, that's an opportunity if we feel that we need more help in, you know, down-regulating our stress response system to take in an experience of affiliation. That's an example. Or more generally, we can, for example, look for those experiences that for us were in short supply, maybe when we were younger. If you recall, here I talked about good facts that are really important. We all know, don't we, the good facts that are our kind of weak spot, or that are hard for us to pay attention to, or that we really, really yearn for and want to pay attention to. Those are opportunities for taking in that kind of good. Okay, questions or comments so far? One. So the question is, what about people who are in environments where they're exposed to inescapable stress? Yeah, inescapable and continuous stress. And let's think of it as sort of like, normal range. Doesn't mean it's good, but we're not talking about someone who's trapped in jail and being tortured every day or something. But, you know, just someone who's has, let's say, is dealing with an aging parent with Alzheimer's who's angry and suspicious and has no bladder or bowel control or something, right? Or one is in, a job where one is forced, there's a lot of bad things that are happening. Okay, great question. One key skill I'll answer this question as if I were talking to the person themselves a little bit, and I'll say things that a lot of us know, but I'm just gonna move through some of the major boxes I think to check. One is to be able to calm the body. Calm the body, which involves parasympathetic nervous system activation. So relax the tongue, touch the lips, exhale, calm the body. That's really important. I was speaking with a really wonderful person earlier at the break, and we were talking about how he doesn't understand. He thinks it's increasingly obvious that everyone should meditate, and my version of that is I think that the ability to relax the body and also the ability to meditate is to the mind what aerobic exercise is to the heart. It's absolutely fundamental to be able to relax at will. So that's a foundation skill. And then you think, okay, how can I help you get that skill better? Both offline, where you learn how to relax your body at night before you go to sleep, or do diaphragm breathing. There are a lot of relaxation techniques that are wonderful. Everybody has their favorite besides this one, right? That's good. But, and then also people can relax in the moment. Second, I think creating a sense, frankly, of healthy distance from the situation as best one can is really important. That's where techniques like NLP is talked about, like looking at the situation through the wrong end of a telescope. Or myself, I will imagine and kind of visualize, and I'll feel, which for me is the felt sense, of being a strong tree through which the wind is whistling, a storm is blowing. Whatever it is, right? Their anger or, you know, the aging parents, you know, completely irrational tirade, and they don't recognize who you even are, even though you've loved them dearly and you've been, you know, taking care of them for some time now. Whatever it is, it's a wind, it's real, it's there, I'm letting it be, I'm with it, I'm present with it, but it's not me, disidentification, and I know at the end of the storm, it will, I'll still be here. I don't know how many of you ever read the sci-fi classic Dune, but there's this meditation on fear. There's a, and basically it talks about fear blows through me, the experience blows through me, and after it passes, I remain. So that would be, and I think it's really important. I will visualize myself a shield going up. I jokingly said earlier, shields up, Scotty. I think this is very important that we have to create safety trumps, you know, joining. Like, people have to feel safe, relatively safe. That's so important. So that would be a second thing. Third thing, I myself do compassion practices for the other people. And it's very interesting that being loving toward them fills me. Isn't that fantastic that it's like that? In other words, that by being compassionate for them, that makes me, or one, feel better. And in that compassion practice, so, you know, I'll just think about how they're having a really bad day. And I'm bumping into their really bad day. I wish it wasn't happening, but here we are. And they look like they're suffering. You know, if what a really great way to not be so upset when we're with people that are upsetting us is to look at their faces and see they're suffering. Not in some kind of know-it-all therapist way, but in a very sincere and humble, and we all suffer here. We all suffer, right? That's, and then the last one is about equanimity, which I'll talk about later, how to promote equanimity. To give a little bit of a preview of that, it's interesting, and I know you know this, that in Buddhism, to use that again as an example, there are these four, you could call them exalted states of being, heavenly abodes, compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, in other words, we're happy that they're happy, and equanimity, right? Of those four, equanimity is probably most important because it's the foundation of the other three. It's very difficult to sustain compassion or sustain kindness or sustain, you know, altruistic joy, sympathetic joy, if we ourselves are really, really rattled. And one way to deepen equanimity when we're with a situation, when we're in a situation or with a person, is just to kind of open up to the 10,000 causes upstream of this moment that have led this moment to be what it is. To literally, someone's mad at me, I'll look at them and I'll just kind of think about all the, what I, you know, and the truth is, of the 10,000 causes, only a handful have our name tag on them. Most of what's happening right there, right now, the stream of causality and conditions that are flowing through and making this moment right what it is, with that person or situation that's coming at us, most of those causes have nothing to do with us. They're generational. You know, they're 100 years upstream. They're embedded in the human nervous system. We had nothing to do with them. And reflecting on that, I find, is a wonderful way to not feel so rattled by it. It's a little bit of a cognitive exercise, but it's quite felt. And then the last one I'll say is to not take it so personally. That goes, you know the acronym RAIN? You know that, R-A-I-N? Yeah. I'll say it, it's a very cool and useful acronym. It comes from mindfulness work of recognize, accept, investigate, not self. So it's kind of like psychological first aid. First we recognize it, I'm getting really mad here, right? Second, we accept. Here it is, it's there. We, as he said in the back of the room, we allow it, we let it be. Right? That's a lot of where I think MBSR comes to play. Then we actively investigate. We don't just be with it, but we actively investigate. We wonder, what caused this? What led to this? What's happening in the deeper layers of the psyche? Why did that little snarky comment from my teenage daughter piss me off so much, right? That little signal hit some kind of preamp inside my brain, and what was, you know, on the 0 to 10 bad behavior scale, a 2 maybe, hit me, and I'm a 7 on the 0 to 10 upscale scale, right? What's going on here? Or that's investigate. And then N, not self. Not take it so personally. not attribute so much intentionality to them. This is a really important notion that's common in psychology, the attribution of intentionality, attribution of intentions to others. We attribute intentions, not necessarily attributing intentions that they meant to do it on purpose or they specifically targeted me. And then, if one is so inclined, and this was the most fun, this was one of the most fun chapters for me to write, is the last one in my book about not self in the brain, basically, or self as a unicorn, it's a mythical creature. The representations of it are real, but that which it points to is not. Right? Don't want to go there any further, but that's a pretty deep end of the pool. But to feel into the ways in which, you know, Rick or Joe or Sam or whatever your name is, or the person or Susie, you know, is more like this sort of distributed Maha eddy in the stream that swirls and changes, and this thing is happening and it's not that good and I wish it wasn't happening here. But it doesn't have to be so personal. It doesn't have to be so about me. I don't have to feel so implicated in it, implicated by it. It's a condition. It's a tough condition. I'm dealing with it, but then I'm going to move on. Actually, since I'm doing this one, the last one, I promise, is refuge. I think refuge is critically important, and it's a wonderful traditional resource in the wisdom traditions of the world, but I don't think it's been enough of a resource in, you know, modern psychology. The appreciation of and the humility of realizing that we need refuge. You know, Western culture is not a very humble culture, is it? But to appreciate the fact that I need these, my places of sanctuary and refueling and protection and, you know, just curling up under the blanket over my head or watching ESPN. You know what I mean? Killing some brain cells, whatever, you know, whatever the refuge is, or being in a certain place, or feeling a sense of contact with a certain person, refuge is really important. And of course, the ultimate refuge is the felt sense of our own true nature. So that even if I'm trapped in this crappy job because I've got mouths to feed and a life to live, or out of my virtues, I'm engaged in this life in which I'm taking care of someone who's making my life miserable, even that, even though that's happening, none of that is sullying or damaging or tainting the essence of who I am, which is the space in which all this is occurring. Ultimately, if you're so inclined, connected to the ultimate transcendental, you know, aspects. And being able to find that quality of refuge amidst the difficulties is very, very useful. Okay. You know, there's this parable. It's, I'll tell you a little. This is a teaching from Taoism, Chuang Tzu, who is Lao Tzu's sort of immediate successor, major person. It's not quite clear who these figures were historically, whether it was one person or several, but he tells this story. So I'll tell you the story and then we'll move on, okay? Imagine a situation, and we're going to do this twice, and it relates to this question here. Imagine that you're in a canoe in a river, let's say. Slow-moving river, Sunday picnic with your sweetie, dressed up really nicely, got grandma's silver there, precious silverware. It's a beautiful picnic lunch. It's just wonderful, all right? Everything's going great. And then suddenly, whoa, there's a loud bang against the side of the canoe, and it tips over, and it dumps you into the river. Oh, my gosh, right? You come up sputtering, hair's wrecked, clothes are ruined, grandma's silver, irrecoverable at the bottom of the stream. You know, it's, what? Water's cold. You come up, what do you see? Two teenage boys wearing snorkels and masks have drifted downstream and, as a joke, tipped over your canoe, and they're laughing. How do you feel? You need some therapy, right? Right then and there, anyone would need therapy. How do we feel, right? Not good. Okay, now take two. Everything's the same. You're in the canoe, the river, the picnic, you're with your friend. Suddenly, loud thump, boom, dumped in the river, come up sputtering, hair's ruined, grandma's silver, bottom of the river. This time, what do you see? A large submerged log has drifted downstream, smacked into the canoe, and dumped you into the river. Now, how do you feel? And what's the difference between the two? The log isn't a person, what, Don? Interpretation, yeah. Maybe you don't like being, I wouldn't, we would probably wouldn't like being in the river. It's a drag, a bad thing happened. To use the traditional metaphor, the first dart has definitely landed. Not one of the big darts of old age, disease, and death, just a little one like being dumped in the river, right? It's definitely landed, but we don't need to add to it all the second darts of taking it personally. The truth is, most of the time, what bumps up against us in life is a log, not a teenager that's picking on us. It's a log. And yes, it's a drag. Yes, we should do what we could to deal with the logs. Yes, it even makes sense to get a different river. Right? But fundamentally, looking at these conditions in a not-so-personal way as just flows, it doesn't mean letting other people off the hook, morally and culpably, but seeing the larger factors that are flowing through that led that log at this moment to bump into my canoe, that really can reduce the sense of suffering. Okay. So let's do a few more things, then we'll take a quick little break. All right? So how do we do taking in the good to heal painful, even traumatic experiences? Let's take a look at memory. And I'm going to move through a fair amount of material briskly here, and then let's do a little practice, and then we'll take a break. All right? Okay, good. So, perfect. All right, we're in good shape. So, memory. This may be familiar to a lot of people here. The way memory works is really interesting, and the brain is different from a computer. If I want to recall a picture I took a picture of this room because I want to remember it. Maybe I should take a picture of you all. I don't know, that might be too scary for all of us, but so I come back, I want this picture. My hard drive has a complete record of the picture, right? So I retrieve the picture to bring it up onto my screen, boop, comes up in total. Brain does not do that. First, the brain stores only a few schematic elements of whatever it is we're remembering, both explicit memory and implicit memory. It just stores a few schematic elements, and then when we retrieve it, it doesn't have a whole record to grab, no, because it's so fast, the brain just builds it all from scratch, which is a really efficient way to use storage capacities, because as we go through life, we have so many experiences. If we had eidetic recall, perfect recall, we would exceed the storage capacities of our brain fairly quickly. That creates a great opportunity, because when we bring something into awareness, into the field of awareness, into the neural substrate, working memory, et cetera, upper, outer, lateral side part of the brain, when we do that and then we stop thinking about it, the material that was just there gets put back into storage. But it's not like the whole file folder gets put back into a certain file in toto. No, the brain consolidates that memory in a way that's kind of complex and therefore very vulnerable. For example, certain kind of protein synthesis needs to occur for people to consolidate memory. So for example, if you take a rat and you train that rat that down the right-hand fork is electric shock. Left-hand fork cheese, right-hand fork shock, right, a couple trials, rats are smart, right-hand fork big pain, all right? Then if you, for example, nudge the rat down the right-hand fork, and then very quickly, and then you pull it out of the tunnel, so it's no longer in pain, right? The painful stimulus is now leaving the field of awareness or the equivalent in a rat and going back down into storage, just getting consolidated. If at that moment you inject a rat with some drugs that block protein synthesis of a certain sort, you erase the memory. And if you put the rat back in the maze, the rat will go down the right-hand tunnel 50% of the time because it doesn't remember that that's where the shock was. Now, those drugs, because you can see the immediate implication, can't you, for healing trauma, those drugs are too toxic to use in humans. That's why mental activity is, if you will, the scalpel that we're going to use to build on this particular trick of memory for helping to heal painful experiences. The point is that if you also hold in awareness at the time of the painful experience a positive material. If those two are held in awareness at the same time, the positive material gradually imbues the negative material with its own associations. And then when the person shifts their attention onto the next thing, and that negative material gets reconsolidated back into long-term storage, it takes with it some of the positive associations that were also held in working memory. Yeah. I'll answer that question. And if I don't, catch me on it, okay? Yeah. Yes. I'll answer, I think, both the questions this way. And if I don't, let me know. So here's the fourth step of taking the good. The first three are foundational. We can do them any time. We can even use the first three in targeted ways to help heal the wounds of the heart and to build capacities over time to deal with painful experiences. The fourth step takes that one step further. And it says, essentially, to use this pairing process where we're pairing a positive and a negative together in conscious awareness. We're doing it mindfully. When we can do that in one of two ways. One way is we're going through life and we have a positive experience. Let's suppose that, using myself as an example, I go through life and I'm in a situation suddenly where I feel appreciated, seen and appreciated. Feels really good. Then what I could do in this first bullet point up here is to sense that that positive experience here and now is sinking down into and soothing and gradually replacing old pain. And I do that, and this is the critical mechanism of action of the fourth step of taking the good, by first holding two things in mind at once. So we have to have the capacity for divided attention, which involves some executive functions. And second, have the positive experience be prominent and intense, and the negative experience be dim and fairly mild. If a person cannot divide their attention, they can't do the fourth step. And if a person, let's say, cannot bring to mind negative material without getting sucked into it, in other words, someone with significant PTSD, let's say, then they can't do the fourth step and shouldn't do it. Because if you're just sucked into the negative material, those neurons are firing and therefore wiring to no avail. There's no value added. The other way to do the fourth step of taking in the good, which I think gets at your question there, is when you're having painful material arise. Let's suppose that some memory is surfacing that's very difficult, or let's suppose that it's not based on previous life experiences, but is something difficult here and now. In an artful way, underline, there's a place for staying present. That's the first step, to let be, if you will. Let be the negative. But then at some artful moment, which could be within a few seconds or a few minutes or days, we can also call to mind some positive experience. And then, boom, we're holding both in awareness for 10, 20, 30 seconds while making the positive experience dominant, if you forgive that word. In other words, more intense and more powerful. That's the fundamental nature of this fourth step. In other words, the point is we're not resisting the negative, and we're not getting attached to the positive, but we are helping ourselves feel better, which is worth doing in its own right, as well as cultivate all the various resources and capabilities and inclinations of mind and heart that I've listed in previous slides and we've talked about here. That's why we do this fourth step of taking in the good, which we'll practice shortly. All right? So that spoke to those two questions, right, I think? In other words, you're holding two things in mind, and there are two opportunities to do that. One is when you start with something positive, and then you have it sink into something old and negative, or when you start with something negative, and you call to mind something positive. obviously there's a pitfall here of developing a kind of Pollyanna spirit that resists negative experiences and just wants to paper them over and cover them up. Let's presume that we're going to avoid that pitfall and we're just going to use these methods in a skillful way. The interesting traditional metaphor that I think is germane here is that of a raft. In other words, when we come to the river of suffering and we want to cross it, we build a raft. We create skillful means and tools and perspectives that get us across the stream. And we cultivate certain faculties or qualities with ourselves, or we heal certain wounds by certain activities. When we get to the other side of the river of suffering, we don't keep carrying the raft around on our head. Right? We set the raft down, and then we move on. Part of the point of doing this practice of taking in the good is to develop internalized resources so we reach for them less in the outer world. Yeah, in the back. Undertow. Yep. Yeah, and again, I'm going to get into those for sure, and it's totally fine to ask that. I think a number of the things I said to the woman here in the front row are relevant there. I'll tell you what I do. This is a sidebar, but I do it myself. I think of it as psychological first aid. It's got four steps, and they usually take a few seconds with some practice. One, pause. I think that's the first step of RAIN, recognize, you know, just stop, just pause, whoa, what's up, you know? And then the second one is self-compassion, just, oh, I'm going to talk about self-compassion in a moment, we'll do a practice of self-compassion, a fantastic resource. Just like, wow, this hurts. And compassion is the wish that beings not suffer, combined with a certain kind of sympathetic concern. So we're just doing for ourselves what we would do for others. In other words, it's just an emotion combined with a kind of wish that, you know, ah, this hurts, this sucks, ouch, yuck, And it's a few seconds. And then, third step, I personally do, I think it's psychological first aid, get on my own side. Get on my own side. Be for myself, not against others, but for myself. Like, this sucks, yuck, I don't want to feel this way. Or, I want to solve this problem. I want to figure out how to pay my rent. Or, I want to figure out how to deal with this weird situation with my daughter's creepy seventh grade teacher. Right? And often there's a very strong, there's a felt sense that's quite somatic, which I think is important. In terms of getting on one's own side, like activating experiences often that have a physicality to them, I think is good. Is what works for many people, of you know, like lifting weights or going rock climbing or just getting through a tough situation, coming through a tough thing like being in the hospital for a while, what have you. I visualize Gandalf at the bridge. I'm a big Lord of the Rings nut, you know, in Barad-dûr. No, you shall not pass. You know, my inner Gandalf. I'm channeling him, it's good stuff. Balrog, no way, Balrog. Anyway, so whatever works, right? Whatever works. That's a part of what I kind of want to, in a sense, as a subtext, is just say different things work for different people. Whatever works, you know? And then the last one, then, after pause, self-compassion, get on my own side, is make a plan. I think a lot of the times that, you know, people are anxious or they have difficulties. You know, there's a place for taking up arms against the oppressors or doing something. I think that, you know, make a plan, take action. And minimally make a plan for the actions we're going to take inside our own mind, which might simply be, all I can do is bear this with grace and dignity and as much non-harming as possible, and that's the best I can do. In the range of options, that's at the high end of the range. Good on me for hanging out at the high end of the range in this sucky situation. Okay. So how might the fourth step of taking in the good work inside the brain? this is kind of fun to think about, actually. So, number one, in through mechanisms that are fairly familiar, extinction. If you pair a positive, if you pair two stimuli together, one can extinguish the other. That's behaviorism, right? 101. Second, what the fourth step does, because you've got to sustain, and when we do this in a moment, you'll see it's kind of an odd thing to do with the mind, even though everyone has done it at least once or twice naturally in life, but it's a little odd. You got to sustain, by the way, again, I'll just say something I said earlier. I don't think this slide is in your handout. I apologize for that. I just kept working. I couldn't stop myself. And I will email you this slide set as a PDF, okay? All right, good. Anyway, to sustain this positive experience and stay with it in the face of the gravitational undertow of the Kraken or the trauma or the creepy stepfather or mother we had, what have you, that involves reinforcing more top-down PFC and hippocampal activation. The hippocampus is involved in context. We're continually to remind ourselves of the context of this situation, the larger picture, the 10,000 causes, if you will. Okay, that's the second thing. The third way that, to me, plausibly, the neurology of TIG4, the fourth step, might unfold is that it reinforces self-directed regulation of negative experiences. In other words, it's do-it-yourself. I'm really interested in what people do when they're not in the therapist's office, right? 168 hours in a week. What about the 167 when they're not sitting across from me? It really matters, let alone, you know, the 50 years, hopefully, they spend, you know, away from me, right? So being able to do it yourself is critically important. And so if one does this, taking in the good on their own, they're reinforcing that sense of, I can do something inside my own mind that's helpful. Also, if you bring up this positive experience, it dampens these secondary associations to negative material, including the fear of the negative material. My own theory of neurosis, informally, is basically most neurosis is about avoiding the dreaded experience, or more exactly, avoiding risking the dreaded experience, or a dreaded experience. In other words, we go through life, we either have horrible experiences because of our lousy childhood, or we watch other people having horrible experiences because they're our sibling, or someone else in school, or whatever, or we watch our parents, and we think to it, and those experiences become dreaded. Critical point, it's not so much the event we dread. The event is a proxy for the experience that we fear will follow. It's the experience that we dread. So we dread the experience, and so we live our lives to avoid risking the possibility of the dreaded experience, of shame, humiliation, reaching high, falling short, living through the Japanese proverb, the nail that stands out gets hammered down, right? We dread whatever that is, that feeling of being hammered down. And so we live our life in a shrunken state. You know, we pull in and we live like that. So much of what we're doing with ourselves as we grow, and certainly with our clients as well, is helping people to tolerate risking the dreaded experience, including sometimes through carefully devised experiments where they deliberately risk the dreaded experience in a high odds framework in which it's almost certain that it'll all turn out okay. And then when it turns out okay, take in the good, right? That's one of the most powerful ways to grow, is to deliberately challenge the fear of the dreaded experience, or notice that even if I'm having this experience, it's really not so bad. I think that's where MBSR is an extraordinary tool in a person's toolbox as they go through the along the road of life. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, and then reduces defenses, you got that. Okay, let's talk about this and then let's do it. Yeah, please. Was not effective? So the question is, if someone is in a major depressive episode, which is not garden variety dysthymic disorder, right? Or just feeling kind of melancholy or bummed. It's like serious clinical depression. So the question then becomes, to what I think, the broad version maybe of the question here is, to what extent are positive emotional experiences accessible, internalizable, and efficacious, right? Number one, they're often hard to access. And that's part of the trouble. You know, it's trying to light a fire with really, really wet wood. How do you kindle a positive experience? Second, on the other hand, if a person can have a positive experience, and interestingly, often depressed people will report positive experiences, including sensual experiences. You know, the chocolate truffle still tastes sweet. The hot shower still feels good, right? But it doesn't matter that it feels good, in a sense. But the point is, the neurological capacity to have positive experience has been conserved. It's still intact. That's good. So we're scratching and clawing here. We're looking for resources, number one. Number two, if a person does have that positive experience, can they internalize it? I think they can if they sustain attention to it. Because if you sustain attention to anything, neural structure starts forming, for better or worse. You cannot stop the brain from doing that, for better or worse. And so if they can sustain mindful attention to the pleasure of the orange or the warm feeling they're having with someone, they're going to be building neural structure. The problem is, you don't, right, working with depressed people, is that it's hard to sustain this positive experience, particularly hard. It's like depression is this awful smothering cloud. But to the extent that they could sustain that positive experience, you can't help firing those and wiring those neurons together. And then last, would it be efficacious? Could they access that as a resource state for themselves in the future? I think that in principle they could, because if it's an implicit memory, it's an implicit memory. You know, there's some findings that depression disrupts memory capacity. Obviously, it disrupts concentration. It just messes with the mind. And there are multiple kinds of depression. So I do have to say, I think that this method may not be that useful for people in that state of mind. I think there a lot of what is helpful, and it's kind of something we talked about at lunch too, is this idea of preparatory conditions. Very often, I'll speak for myself, I've tried to build the second floor without first taking care of the basement. So I jump to, I'm too quick, you know, you probably noticed that already today, but I just go to the next thing. And so I'm with my clients and I really want to help them, right? We want to help our clients. So we say, well, you can do this. Yeah, if they knew how to do this, 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 and that first, we have to slow down, we have to be patient. I think about one of the 10 qualities of a bodhisattva is patience, which has been a watchword for me lately because I need it. It's to slow down and just, things take the time they take. There's an organic process here. You can't make a tomato plant make a tomato, you know, according to your schedule. So then I would think about, okay, what could promote the person's capacity to have positive experiences. So I would think about dopamine regulation. Dopamine's a major target of antidepressants as well. I think about other, neurotransmitters, you know, that may be involved in supporting. I think that's one reason why exercise is actually useful for depression. I never realized this, as a mechanism of action, because if you exercise, you're getting sympathetic arousal. You're activating the sympathetic nervous system in a healthy way. So you're getting, you can't help it. A person's getting surges of norepinephrine, you know, as an arousing, sometimes stress hormone. And when that happens, the person's capacity for positive experiences is increased, which is, I think, at least one of the reasons why exercise is pretty much as effective as an antidepressant for, you know, mild to moderate depression. Okay. But the larger point there is, I think, to get at this idea of what might be preparatory factors, and think about getting those going, and then on the basis of them, okay, now let's do the thing we really want to do. Let's do a practice, okay? Let's actually do it. Good. Let's do a brief practice of self-compassion, and then we'll take a break, okay? And Okay. So as you see on the slide here, compassion is the wish that one not suffer. And so we're going to do a brief self-compassion practice, and I'll take you through several suggestions that are kind of neurologically informed, because a lot of people actually have difficulties with self-compassion, even though self-compassion, research has shown, is important for lifting mood, you know, including depression. It promotes resilience. It dampens the stress response. I think it improves immune function. And it definitely promotes resilience over time. And most of the benefits of self-esteem really boil down to self-compassion. So it's a really good thing. All right. So let's do a little practice here about it. And like all practices, you know, go your own way. The first step is to bring to mind the felt sense of being with someone that you know cares about you. So if you can, bring to mind the sense of being with someone who cares about you, a pet, animal companion, God, your mate, your children, friend, and focus on feeling cared about. That feeling crumbles, see if you can regenerate it, and stay with feeling cared about, feeling like you belong, like you matter, maybe even cherished. All right, the second suggestion is to bring to mind a person or group of people, or even in animals, that you naturally feel compassion for. Strong feelings of compassion. The wish that they not suffer, and emotions of sympathetic concern. And it's fine if these steps are blur into each other. And then third, see if you can swing that same compassion to yourself. Maybe a sense of you at a younger age. Or maybe a sense of your innermost being here and now. See if you can bring that same compassion to yourself today. Maybe combined with certain phrases like, may I not suffer. May this worry pass. May this pain diminish. May the loss of my father, my mother, my mate ease over time. Sinking into the sense of self-compassion and taking it in, taking in the good of self-compassion. Okay, great. Come on back. Could one or two people just sort of share like how that was for you, and then I'll make an announcement, and then we'll take a break. Anybody? Could you do that? So first, could you get a sense of feeling cared about? Can people access that? Yeah, that's a very important preparatory condition, because for many reasons, a neurological reason why that's a good preparatory condition. Mm-hmm. Is it lights up the attachment circuitry of the brain, which is very ancient and very powerful. when we feel cared about. And it's kind of non-specific circuitry. It's general. It just, you know, and one of the fastest ways to light it up is to bring to mind the sense of being loved. Okay, then were you able to find a sense of compassion for somebody else, like a child or a pet or a, you know, a starving person or something like that? Yeah. And then can you shift that to yourself? That's harder. I saw some head shaking. Yeah, which is very normal. That said, if you're finding that shifting that simple human, you know, wish that one not suffer and tender concern, if it's hard to shift to yourself, that's definitely something to practice with. That's a good practice to develop because that's an important resource to have. You know, one of the breakthroughs for me about that was on a meditation retreat where I was so lost in the sense of the allness of everything and then, you know, the lack of I, that I began to despair of, like, what's the point of living, in a way? Like, how does all that work? And I wrote about this a bit in the book. And the end of that, one part of the end of that was to recognize that if we are to be compassionate to all beings, if somebody, you know, brings that to mind, one of those all beings has our name tag. You know, there's a term you may know in psychology, negative grandiosity. Like, I'm so special that I deserve nothing like other people get. Right? That's negative grandiosity. Self-compassion is a really, really good thing. Okay, so let's have some self-compassion. Oh, I have a couple quick announcements. Wait. One is that if you care, and if you, like, some people have to leave right afterward, I'll stick around, but if, perchance, you'd like me to sign a book, which I always feel honored about doing, I'll do that during this break. And then I think Tim has some announcements maybe about upcoming programs. I've just personally found that Open Ground is amazing. And, you know, clearly they offer, you know, first-rate training, present company, you know, this one excluded. But anyway, they offer really, really good trainings. And obviously have really, really good results. So did you want to say anything? Or?
Yeah.